This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
Stay tuned for our bulletin of church news, which will be followed by Panorama, and then our feature, Development and the Economy. We shall close with a reflection on this coming Sunday's Gospel passage. I am John Baptist Tumusime. On Friday, Pope Francis received an audience participants at a three-day meeting organized by the Ecological Initiative of the Focolare Movement, known as Eco One. The meeting started on Friday in Rome and will end on Sunday. The participants, guided by the theme, New Ways Towards Integral Ecology, are discussing the role that individuals and social bodies can play in the care of the earth in light of Pope Francis's encyclical Laudato Si. In that encyclical launched in 2015, the Pope discussed the environmental crisis and emphasized the need to enter into dialogue with all people to save this planet before it is too late. In his address, Pope Francis recalled the late foundress of the Focolare Movement, Chiara Rubic, who many times spoke out against environmental degradation and pointed out that all created things are connected, and that concern for the environment needs to be joined to sincere love for our fellow human beings and a sincere commitment to resolving the problems of society. The Pope pointed out that to protect Mother Earth from further harm, there is an urgent need for a new and more inclusive socio-economic model that reflects that we are one family sharing the same Creator, children of the same Earth, which is our common home. He invited the participants in their discussions to point out the problems caused by exploitation and selfishness, and to promote the practice of a moderate, simple, and humble lifestyle. He prayed that their work may cultivate in the hearts of people a shared responsibility for one another as children of God, and a renewed commitment to be good stewards of God's gift of creation. The Holy See's Apostolic Penitentiary issued a decree on Friday extending indulgences for the faithful departed throughout the month of November. The head of the Apostolic Penitentiary, Cardinal Mauro Piacenza, said in the decree that pastors in different parts of the world have asked for the modification to ensure the safety of the faithful at this time of the COVID-19 pandemic, which has restricted movement and gatherings. Sister Bernadette Rees has the details.
The plenary indulgence for the deceased, associated with a visit to a cemetery between the 1st and the 8th of November, can be obtained by anyone who visits a cemetery, even if only mentally, on any day in November, and devoutly prays for the faithful departed. Regarding the plenary indulgence attached to All Souls Day, the 2nd of November, this year it can be obtained not only on the preceding or succeeding Sunday or on the actual feast day, but on any other day of the month, chosen by each member of the faithful. In this case, the indulgence is obtained by devoutly visiting a church or an oratory, along with the recitation of the Our Father and the Creed, and the other requirements associated with a plenary indulgence. For anyone who cannot leave their homes for various reasons, including anti-COVID restrictions in place, they too can obtain the plenary indulgence by uniting themselves spiritually to other members of the faithful. In this case, the condition of being completely detached from sin and the intention of completing the other requirements for obtaining a plenary indulgence remain. These conditions are sacramental confession, reception of Holy Communion, and a prayer for the Holy Father's intentions. The decree suggests that such prayer take place before an image of Jesus or the Blessed Virgin Mary. Among the various prayers that are recommended are prayers for the deceased, morning or evening prayer from the office of the dead, the rosary, the Divine Mercy chaplet, meditating on various gospel passages proposed for the liturgy of the dead, or completing a work of mercy by offering to God the suffering and discomforts of one's own life. Directing a word to priests, the decree asks that they make the sacrament of confession generously available and that they make Holy Communion available to the sick. In addition, all priests are invited to offer three masses on All Souls Day. I'm Sister Bernadette Reese.
The Archbishop of Lagos in Nigeria, His Grace Alfred Adewale Martins, has called upon the faithful to pray for peace in the country. The call comes amidst protests by the citizens against police brutality. The protests started on October 8th after a video showing police officers of the Special Anti-Robbery Squad shooting and killing a man in the country's Delta State. On October 11th, Nigeria's Inspector General of Police announced the disbandment of the Special Anti-Robbery Squad with immediate effect. However, the demonstrations have continued, with the protesters now demanding reforms in the country's structure of governance. According to reports, security agencies have killed many protesters. Archbishop Martins invited the faithful to pray the rosary, seeking the intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary, the Mother of Peace. You are tuned to the English Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
Libya's warring sides have signed an agreement for a permanent ceasefire in all areas of the country. Friday's accord in Geneva came after days of talks between military representatives of the internationally recognized government in Tripoli and General Khalifa Haftar's eastern-based Libyan forces. In comments after the signing, UN Acting Libya Envoy Stephanie Williams hailed both sides for reaching a deal. Friday's agreement will be followed by political discussions in Tunisia next month. President Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria has urged protesters to stop demonstrating and instead engage with the government in finding solutions. The president made the appeal in a televised address to the nation on Thursday, the first since protests against police brutality began 3 weeks ago. However, Mr. Buhari's address has been widely criticized after he failed to mention the shooting of protesters in Lagos. The Special Anti-Robbery Squad, known as SARS, which has been at the center of protests against police brutality, was dissolved on 11th of October. Amnesty International has said security forces killed at least 12 people in Lagos, although Nigeria's army has denied its involvement. On Thursday, the human rights group called for an immediate and thorough investigation of allegations of unlawful killing and use of excessive force against protesters in Lagos on the evening of Tuesday, the 20th of October. Meanwhile, a group that has been key in organizing the protests against police brutality in Nigeria has urged people to stay home. The Feminist Coalition, which has been using the hashtag #EndSARS to rally protesters, also advised people to follow any curfews that may be in place in their states. In a statement posted on Twitter, the group said it condemned every form of violence that had occurred, saying that young Nigerians need to stay alive to pursue, quote, our dreams to build a future. Mali's military says it has regained control of a village in the center of the country where more than 2,000 residents have been besieged by suspected Islamist militants for 2 weeks. The siege began a fortnight ago when militants kidnapped several people in Farabugu, most of whom are of the farming Bambara ethnic group. Malian troops had been unable to reach the village by land because of heavy rains. A military statement said soldiers were able to penetrate the area on Thursday in a mission aided by the Air Force. And police in Tanzania have confirmed that more than 300 armed men from Mozambique carried out a raid on a village in southern Tanzania, killing a number of villagers. You are tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
This is Development and Economy, and you are welcome to the program. My name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. In our program last week, iconic international architect Norman Foster told us that once the COVID-19 pandemic is behind us, all indications are that cities are going to be greener, cleaner, quieter, safer, and more secure. Foster was sharing this belief on the sidelines of a meeting of mayors from dozens of world cities organized by the United Nations Economic Commission for Europe in Geneva. Today in this edition, we hear more from Lord Foster as he talks to Daniel Johnson in a wide-ranging interview in which he discusses how cities have emerged stronger from disaster in the past and how they will likely look in the future. Foster believes that COVID-19 is a wake-up call for mayors to transform their cities for better.
So you mentioned those pea soupers of the 1950s, not only in London, Manchester and all over the world. In fact, we still have them, and we saw them in many cities that are now clean since the COVID-19 pandemic. Do you think that we might see with COVID, you do mention it being an opportunity perhaps for mayors to transform things. Do you think we're going to see a really radical change in the way that we approach our cities' built environments?
We'll see an acceleration of change. We'll see new attitudes on behalf of the citizens, because they have seen that transformation. But what it's doing is magnifying and speeding up trends that were already with us before. That's positive.
Okay, and I wanted to ask you about your particular and your personal vision of what sustainability means. How would you define it?
I'd say that sustainability brings you closer to nature. By nature, we are linked to the changing seasons, to the outdoor world, to greenery, to landscape. So if that brings us closer to that, that's going to make us healthier, it's going to make us happier, it's going to be a better quality of life.
And there's no clash between being close to nature and cities?
No. I mean, some of the best cities have the best parks, access to avenues of trees, shade, wildlife. So in that sense, I don't see a conflict between a green future and a quality of life. The two go hand in hand. It's not that you have to sacrifice one to have the other.
On to my next question, and staying with sustainability and the Sustainable Development Goals, which, as you know, are 17 goals to tackle everything from poverty to food insecurity to inequality that were agreed by the international community back in 2015 now. So we've got 10 years before 2030, which is the deadline to achieve all 17 of these goals. I just had a question about inequality, which is SDG 10, I believe. Now, I have bad hearing, and it's one of my bugbears in these big old buildings here in the UN Palais des Nations. When people do start to talk and move around in these buildings, everything makes a huge old racket, so it's very difficult for people with disabilities to use the buildings that we all need. And in cities, of course, you have the same problem, whether it's airports or big cavernous spaces where the sound rebounds. Have you personally, you know, in your career as an architect and an urbanist, has it changed at all as you've sort of mellowed with age? Have you become less striking in your designs and more accommodating in what you're trying to achieve?
I think the two go hand in hand. So trying to take your question apart, the ultimately sustainable building is one that can be recycled and not destroyed and replaced. That's not in any way to undermine the validity of the new building. Of course, cities have to renew. So there is no reason. The technology is available to be able to take this building and transform it, recycle it, bring it up to date with new internal systems. If I take the most sustainable building that's been created so far, it's the Bloomberg headquarters. Working with Mike Bloomberg there, Mike wants wood floors. But wood floors in a dense office building, you'd say it was a no-no. But by design, by the ceiling surfaces which work acoustically, which cut the energy load, which give you better quality of lighting, all of those things are possible. So the idea of being radical doesn't mean that you're going to be uncomfortable. Quite the reverse. The idea is to improve the quality of life. And that is the most sustainable building that's been designed and built so far. It's also a very social building. It has the pantry. The circulation means that you have to go there before you go to the workplace. So it's very much about the encounter, about the creativity that comes out of that. And that building is naturally ventilated, so it saves energy and it's healthier. But then that's a kind of fringe building because I can quote Steve Jobs and Apple. I can talk about an individual like Brian Roberts and the Comcast building in the same way as Bloomberg. Those have happened. They're kind of fringe buildings. Those are likely to become the new norm as people demand healthier buildings. And why not?
Well, that sounds very good, and I'd love to see what you could do with the UN Palais because, you know, it was built for the League of Nations, and it is undergoing a restoration because parts of it are not in great shape. You should certainly take the tour one day. You might be inspired. And what you were saying about wooden floors also reminds me of wooden cobbles in Barcelona in one of the Gaudi houses I visited there. So that really striking how it comes full circle. I'm not sure whether they had the same view to energy efficiency as you have today, but it's clear that data is a massively important thing in anything you do, because it's a huge gamble, I suppose. You would say it's not a gamble because you know that you're putting in a building that's going to be softening the impact.
I think that is the difference between then and now, and that is the ability of not just the technology of the building, but the technology of anticipation, design anticipation. So it is possible to use the computer technology to simulate the movement of air, to explore that, and to be far more predictive. That doesn't mean in the past the process of trial and error and the accumulation of knowledge. So it's important to, in that sense, when you're designing with an awareness of the past, the needs of the present, but you're also looking to a future which is unknown. And those buildings which have the longest life have been able to adapt to change. I can think of buildings that I've been involved with where typewriters were the norm, but those buildings have been able to adapt because they anticipated technological change. They had floors that you could wire through. Nobody was to know that the digital revolution would produce screens, but they were able to respond to it by design.
Just two more questions. You're here at this UNECE event, and it has 56 member states from Europe, North America, and Asia. Not all of them are wealthy and able to do maybe the ambitious projects that they would like, according to the sustainable agenda that you really are supporting, and that comes through very clearly. So what is the first thing they should do, no matter where they are on the income scale?
It's not about how much money you spend. It's how wisely you spend it. Quality design is not harnessed to money. The creative element, that is what makes the difference. The two resources are really time and money. But the creative energy, that if you take, there's one engineer in South America who created wonderful architecture out of humble material brick. And I can't remember the exact quote, but the essence of it is extravagance is not related to quality. It's how you use the funds at your disposal. I think the significant thing about today is that the history of the United Nations, 75 years, League of Nations, today I think I would suggest is a turning point because it celebrated the importance of cities and city leaders. And arguably, the combination of cities, city leaders, industry, business, academia has the power to confront climate change far more effectively than governments, which by their nature are slow.
That's very promising, and certainly we've heard calls from Antonio Guterres, UN Secretary General, for more involvement in not only the private sector but civil society. He really wants to get more people telling the United Nations what they want. And my last question to you is about a sort of burning issue in cities around the world. It's informal workers, and they just seem to be invisible, whether it's in the labour market or when it comes to housing. What is the modern 2020 and 2030 response to how we should help the informal sector in cities?
I think it overlaps with the question of affordable housing. to many of these informal workers. And I think one aspect of this pandemic has been the extent to which we appreciate those who serve us. So if they are starting at 4 o'clock in the morning to be able to start leaving home to work at, say, 8 o'clock with the long commute, the challenge is to create accommodation which levels that. I mean, the exciting cities of the past were a real rich mix of right across all the spectrums of different professions, society. We could rediscover that. And there's no reason why a civic initiative shouldn't be able to produce that level of accommodation alongside all the other kinds of activities that coexist in the dense, pedestrian-friendly city.
Lord Norman Foster talking to Daniel Johnson there about how the COVID-19 shock could bring us cleaner, safer and more sustainable cities. And that is all we have time for today in this edition of Development and the Economy. Until next week, at the same time, my name is Kanyan Tagodufrikampamba.
Coming up next, a reflection on this Sunday's readings, prepared and presented by Father Enobong Udaidiong.
The law of love comes from God, urges us to be good to others, having in mind that we will love others to treat us good if we were to find ourselves in the same helpless condition like them. The way we treat others is important in our Christian calling. Our Christian calling makes us strive to live exemplary life in the communities we find ourselves. Yes, human weaknesses often make us want to go against the divine laws. Therefore, the more reason we as Christians should strive the more to live by the tenets of love as taught by Christ. In the Gospel of Matthew chapter 22, a lawyer tested Jesus by saying, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" Jesus responded, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, with all your mind, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." The lawyer's intention was to test Jesus to see if he knows the law. Good enough, Jesus, the fulfillment of the law and the prophets, gave us all the best summary of the whole law and the prophets in these two commandments, love of God and love of our neighbor. These two commandments are inseparable. No one can claim to love God and hate his neighbor, because it is the love of God that urges us to do good to our neighbor. The love of God is made manifest by the love we have for one another. The first reading presents how God intends to treat those who treat others badly, especially the treatment of the less privileged members of the community. God says, "Don't do wrong to strangers. Do not afflict the widow and the orphan. Do no wrong to the poor." If these brethren should cry to God, he says he will answer, and his wrath will burn, and he will have compassion on them. As Christians, it is a common practice that we all claim to love God, and some will take their love of God to a level that their pious devotions are so pronounced in the parish communities, in the society, and in the family. They pray often, fast daily, and are ready to commit themselves daily to the work of God in the church. But when it comes to their relationship with their neighbors, they are found wanting. It is attitudes like these that made St. John in the first epistle, chapter 2, to say, "If you claim to be in the light, but hate your brother, you are still in darkness." He continues by saying, "If you love your brothers and sisters, you remain in the light, and nothing in you will make you fall." The commandment of love makes us walk in the light. Jesus in John's Gospel, chapter 13, verse 34 and 35 says, "I give you a new commandment, love one another, just as I have loved you, you also must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. The commandment of love is meant to make us more like God, because God is love. The salvific action of God is motivated by love, as presented in John's Gospel, chapter 3, verse 16. Our actions as Christians towards God and our neighbor should be motivated by love. Our love for one another is the concrete expression of our love for God. We can only show our love for God by doing good to others, treating others as we would like others to treat us. Hence, as Christians, St. Paul in the second reading invites us to be imitators of Christ by not only professing our faith, but by also living out the faith. Faith without good works, St. James says, is dead. The good works we do to others are lasting testimonies of our Christian calling. How do we witness to the love of God in our family, office, and in the community? Which of the qualities of love do we exhibit? Is it patience and kindness? Do you know that love is not envious, not boastful, not arrogant, is not ill-mannered, does not seek its own interest, does not take delight in wrong, but rejoices in truth? Let us then pray for a loving heart. May the message of Christ in all its richness continue to find a home in our hearts through the same Christ our Lord. Amen. Peace be with you.
That was a reflection by Father Enobong Udaidion from Nigeria. You have been listening to the English Africa service of Vatican Radio, and I am Johnny Baptist Tumosime. In our next program at the same time tomorrow, you can hear our feature, The World Around Us. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.